We are starting the book of Judges tonight. This is the time period in Israel's history after Joshua and before Samuel and Saul and David and the era of the kings. It covers a period of about 350 years. And a theme verse in the book is the very last verse in Judges 21, verse 25. It says, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And that is repeated actually three other times at the end of the book. And they're not saying, the author of this is not simply saying that it's just prior to the time of the kings, because Israel had a king at this point. They had an invisible king. They had God as their ruler and their commander. But what they're saying here is that everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. They were just acting their own way, doing whatever they felt was best in their own life. If you look at our culture today, it's not much different. You know, we have different leaders, but for the most part, our country and our culture is a culture where everyone is doing what is right within our own eyes. It's kind of three basic cultures in life. There's a theonomous culture. It's a culture where God's law is embedded into hearts, and we realize that he is the creator, and so there is a recognition of that authority over our life. And then there is a heteronomous culture, and this is, hetero means another or other, and nomos is law. And this is where the mainstream of the culture is dictated to by the leadership from top. So you could think of Marxism or Islam cultures, where you have a few people at the top that are kind of dictating everything else for the rest of the culture. And then you have the autonomous culture. And basically that's the self-law. And that's where we're at in our country right now. That's where Israel was at, but they shouldn't have been in that place at that point in time, because they did have God over them. They were living, everyone doing what was right in their own eyes. As we go through chapter 1 tonight, it will be the book's introduction, and then we'll see the second part of that introduction next week. But I do want to give you kind of the big picture. And so after chapter 2, you have chapters 3 through 16, which are the most well-known section of the book. And that is covering the period and the time of the judges. And basically what is covered in those chapters is this reoccurring cycle where God's people had been following God. They compromised, they became corrupt, they experienced some form of captivity or oppression from other people. They cried out to God, and then God delivered them. And then you see corruption again, or compromise, corruption, captivity, crying out to God, and again rescue. And so this occurs six times within those chapters. And one of the things that God uses repeatedly to help bring the people back out of their tragedy is different human rescuers. And these were known as the judges. Now, the judges, don't think of them as judges today with a gavel and somebody who's, you know, in a courtroom. These were more heroes. They weren't all perfect. Some of them were very flawed individuals. But they were people who were representatives and the rescuers in that time period, to help bring deliverance from different people. And if you were to chronologically kind of line them up, it seems like the timetable doesn't fit. But you have to remember, Israel is a group of different tribes. And so sometimes there's an oppression that's happening in the north, and there's a rescuer up there. And then he overlaps another situation that's happening down the south with a different rescuer down there. And so some of the judges overlap a little bit in their time frame. There are six judges that are well known. Their names are Othniel, Ehud, Deborah, Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson. Probably the two most well known are Gideon and Samson. And then there are six that are more obscure: Shamgar, Tola, Jer. I should have asked if you could name any of these. Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon, or Abdon. So you've got six people that are not really well known and six that are highlighted. And probably the six that are highlighted were those who were the rescuers during times of oppression, and the six that are more obscure were helping give some degree of rule and representation during the times of more peace. So there wasn't probably as much to talk about. But again, there's a great difference in emphasis. So Gideon, guess how many verses he has? It's about 100 verses that are talking about Gideon. How many verses do you think Shamgar gets? He gets one verse. That's all he gets. And then you move on to somebody else. So again, there's a big difference between these two. And then sandwiched in between a lot of these stories is another account of a guy named Abimelech. And we'll talk about him as we get into those chapters. So that is the middle part of the book, the section of the judges with this reoccurring cycle of sin, suffering, supplication, and salvation. And then the conclusion of the book is chapter 17 through 21. It's four chapters. And this is basically a case study with two illustrations describing the condition of the people during this time. And in these two illustrations, there's a depiction of the spiritual corruption. And so chapters 17 and 18 talk about the immorality or the idolatry of the people, how their vertical relationship with God is broken. And then the last few chapters give an illustration of the immorality, how their horizontal relationship with other people is also broken. And so these chapters are really tragic. The book ends just in a mess and a longing for something better and something more. One thing to be thinking about as we get into this book is there's a lot of battles. There's a lot of fighting between the Israelites and the Canaanites and different groups. And they had a responsibility to be able to drive these people out, and they didn't do that. And you think in our lives, how does this relate? You know, how does this connect with you and me today? And we don't have a physical enemy. We don't battle, as Ephesians 6:12 says, against flesh and blood. But our battle is spiritual, and it's also against our sinful nature. It's against our flesh. And so we all have that responsibility, like what is said in Colossians 3:5, of put to death those members of basically our flesh, that old sinful nature. And so we'll see what happens in a nation or what could happen in an individual if there's a neglect of that. So chapter 1 could be titled The Risk of Complacency. And we're going to see how they start out well, verses 1 through 18, but they don't finish strong. Verse 1 says, "Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, 'Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?' And the Lord said, 'Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand.' So Judah said to Simeon, his brother, 'Come up with me to my allotted territory that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory.' And Simeon went with him. Then Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they killed 10,000 men at Bezek. And they found Adonai Bezek in Bezek and fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Then Adonai Bezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him and cut off his big thumbs, or his thumbs and his big toes. And Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings." We don't know if he's exaggerating here or if he's being literal, but he says 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather their food under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. Then they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. Now the children of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. They struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. And afterward, the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites, who dwelt in the mountains, in the south, and in the lowland. Then Judah went against the Canaanites who dwelt in the Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kirjath Arba, and they killed Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. From there they went against the inhabitants of Debir. The name of Debir was formerly Kirjath Sefer. Verse 12, "Then Caleb said, He who attacks Kirjath Sefer and takes it, to him I will give my daughter Aksa as wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So he gave him his daughter Aksa as wife. Now it was so when she came to him that she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you wish?" So she said to him, "Give me a blessing. Since you have given me the land in the south, give me also springs of water." Then Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. Now the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of the palms with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the south near Arad. And they went and dwelt among the people. And Judah went with his brother Simeon, and they attacked the Canaanites who inhabited Zephath and utterly destroyed it. So the name of the city was called Hormah. And also Judah took Gaza with its territory, and Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. So Judah was able to capture some different areas that belonged to the Philistines, which later on we're going to find out the Philistines regained that. But first 18 verses are starting out well. This is a list of positives, and I'd like to bring to your attention four things in these verses that I think are good and positive. And the first is, you see the children of Israel, before they are stepping forward into any of these other battles, what are they doing first? They're seeking God. They're praying. It says in verse 1, after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" So they realize, before we go forward in life, we need the help of God. We want to work with God. We want to walk with God. There's a recognition of God in their life. The book begins in a very different way than the end. It ends, there's no king in Israel. Everyone's doing what was right in their own eyes. Here, if it started that way, what would they do? They'd do whatever was right in their own eyes. They just decide, I think we should be the tribe that should go against this group first. But they're not doing that. They're consulting God. They're praying. And that is one aspect of life that's essential to be able to do well. And I love, if you go through these verses, you see not only is there prayer to the Lord, but in verse 2, you see God promising them that he will deliver them. You see in verse 4, God gives power to fulfill the deliverance. And in verse 19, you see it says the Lord was with Judah. So you have prayer, you have the promise of God, the power of God, and the presence of God, all at work with the people of God here. That's missing later on. There's not the prayer. There's a lack of communication. And so this is one aspect that's at the beginning here. And the Lord answers their prayer. And he says, Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand. Doesn't tell us how the Lord answered. Doesn't give us the method, but we know he did answer. And he's communicating to his people. So that's one aspect that I see as positive. The second aspect that I see, which is a good thing, is there's teamwork. Judah knows I'm supposed to go up, but what does he do before he starts to fight? He taps Simeon, the neighbor tribe, and he says, "Can you come help me?" Now, of all the tribes, Judah's one of the leader tribes, right? He's one of the biggest. He's one that the Lord had promised and prophesied that you would be a leader. If you remember back in Genesis, which we just finished, had Jacob said much to Simeon? That was good. Now, Simeon was one of the guys who, alongside Levi, had made some poor decisions earlier in his life. And so there was a consequence, and basically he wasn't going to become a real great tribe. He was going to be scattered and kind of dispersed and absorbed. And yet, Judah doesn't look at his weaker brother, in a sense, with disdain here and says, "I don't need you to go into the battle." What does he say? He says, "I need you to help me come into the battle." Here's a strong asking help from the weak. And I appreciate that because we often, we realize that the weak need the strong, but here it's the strong realizing we need the weak. And it's a reminder, 1 Corinthians 12, where Paul describes a church and its many members that make up the body. And we can look at other people, and Paul says there's two different errors that we can make in life. We can look at some people and say, well, I'm not part of the body because I'm not as strong as you. I'm not as gifted as you. I'm not talented like you. Therefore, I'm not part of the body. Or we can make the error of saying, I'm more gifted, I'm more talented, I have these attributes, and you don't have these gifts, therefore, you're not part of the body. And Paul says both of these are in error, that the body is many members that are necessary. For example, one of the things that was cut off by this king, and then this king had cut off in this chapter, was what? Not only his thumbs, but what else? Your two big toes, which usually are, you know, hidden in your shoes. Back then, they didn't have shoes. They probably had sandals. But you probably don't think about your toes very much at all, except the times when you have to clip them, right? And yet, how important is a big toe in your life? It's critical for your balance, which is why these people are gathering food. They're completely dependent upon others to provide for them because they can't walk around very well and they're not able to do things. And so Judah, he asks for help, and you see just this teamwork. The tribes are working together. They realize we're one nation, different tribes, but we're one nation. And if you look later in this book, that is fractured. In chapter 8, in chapter 12, and in chapter 20 and elsewhere, there's this infighting and this competition rather than this camaraderie here that we see. So we see teamwork. The third thing that we see is progress. If you look at verses 4 through 11, I won't reread it, but you see they are successful in these battles that they have. And in verse 18, also it says, Judah took Gaza with its territory and Ashkelon and Ekron. And so they were able to take land and take possession. There was progress. Now, you may not be wrestling with this, but I can guarantee you if you talk to a person who is not a Christian and they're reading the Bible and they get to this section or they get to Joshua and they read about Israel going in to drive out these nations, they're going to raise a red flag and think, is this just? Is this right? Is this okay? Because some people will say, well, this looks like genocide to me. This looks like Israel is just wiping other nations out. And this isn't a matter of race. God's not telling his people, wipe these people out because they're Hittites or because they're Canaanites. God had nothing against them because of their nationality. It was because of their immorality. I'd like to read verse in Deuteronomy chapter 9, verses 4 and 5. Deuteronomy 9, verse 4. Do not think in your heart after the Lord your God has cast them out before you, saying, because of my righteousness, the Lord has brought me in to possess this land. But it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out from before you. It is not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you go in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord your God drives them out from before you, and that he may fulfill the word which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he repeats it twice. It's because these people are wicked that they need to be driven out. Also in Leviticus 18, verses 24 and 25, after God has just finished giving them a list of guidelines and laws regarding sexual morality, he says in verse 24, do not defile yourselves with any of these things, for by all these nations are defiled, which I am casting out before you. So if you want to read what they were doing, just read the previous verses. For the land is defiled, therefore I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants. You can also read in Deuteronomy 18, verses 9 through 12, similar thing. So God is commanding them to go in and drive these nations out because they're guilty, not because they're innocent. And so all of these people are under wrath. They're under judgment, and they're unrepentant. And the Lord had said, as you go in, I will drive them out little by little, in Deuteronomy 7. And so we see that. We see just little by little, the children of Israel are gaining ground, kind of like in your walk with God. After you first give your life to the Lord, there's still aspects of your life that don't reflect Christ, lots of aspects of your life. But as you walk with God, little by little, his desire is to change you from glory to glory into the image of Jesus and the likeness of Jesus. And so that's the goal, is to be able to drive all these nations out and have this land be used for the Lord and have the people reflect the image of their God. And then one fourth thing that we see here is in verses 12 through 15, you have this story of Caleb and his relative, Othniel. There's debate regarding what relation he was. It says his younger brother, but brother sometimes could be a little bit ambiguous, but some degree of relative. And then Caleb's daughter. And you think, why did they even throw this in here? This little story in the midst of they had this battle and they won, they killed this king and they conquered here. And then it has this little story of Caleb saying, whoever goes and takes this city gets to marry my daughter. And this guy over here says, well, I want to marry your daughter. So he goes and he takes the city. Why is that even in here? It doesn't tell us. So I'll give you some thoughts. I'm not going to be dogmatic on this. But I think one aspect of this is it demonstrates just that these are real people making a life for themselves. And you could maybe use the word adventure. Because in this, it's a lot more than just, we got to take this city, we got to do this. There's a bit of romance here. There's a bit of adventure where Caleb's, he's kind of just holding something up for other people to get. The city as well as his daughter. And I think he probably talked with his daughter about this. And I don't think that it's a situation where his daughter would be disappointed, because who is she getting to marry? She's marrying a victor. She's marrying a winner, not a loser. And that's probably what Caleb was wanting his daughter to marry, somebody who's succeeding in life, somebody who's making good decisions in life. And so he sets up some guidelines. Whoever's able to do this gets to marry my daughter. So I see this adventure here. And in this, you see real people making a life for themselves. You see dreams. You see vision. When you look at Othniel, he's taking the city for a greater purpose than just to take the city. Why is he taking the city? Because he wants to marry this girl. And so there's a greater vision in mind. The daughter, after she marries Othniel, she also has vision. She has this land. She's got this city. But what does she realize we also need? We need water. And so she has the courage to ask her dad, can I also have this? We've already received something from you, but I believe you're a generous dad. And so I'm going to ask, would you be willing to give this as well? And she talks to her husband about it, and then she talks to her dad. And so you see vision, you see joy, you see generosity, you see just these different aspects of an adventure in life. And I think it just helps give a little bit of color that this isn't supposed to be just a dry chapter with a bunch of names of places we've never been to. We don't know where they exactly are. But it's a little bit more color to this chapter. And Othniel, we'll meet him a little bit later. He ends up becoming the first judge of Israel. Some people may wonder regarding his marriage. Was it right for him to marry Achsa, since he's a relative of Caleb. And again, there's disagreement over what kind of relative he was. So we do know from Leviticus 18, verse 6, the Jews were not supposed to marry close relatives at this point in time anymore. And so we don't know if this is a violation of that or if he's more of a distant relative. We do know that it's simply recorded here. God's not approving of everything that he records. So we don't know that. But again, there's other things that happen in this book that God's recording, but he's not approving of. It's, again, some dark stuff later on. So jump over to verses 19 through 36, and we see them stopping short. Verse 19 says, "So the Lord was with Judah, and they drove out the inhabitants of the mountains, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron." So here we have the first time where there's a lack of progress, where there's a stop. It says they were able to drive out the people of the mountains, but when they get to the lowland, they couldn't do it because they had chariots of iron. And then if you look at verse 21, it says, "But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwelt with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day." So you've got two situations where you have two tribes, unsuccessful in some battles. Now, I think that in these situations, these are excuses, not roadblocks that prevent them from actually being able to succeed. Because if you go back and you read Joshua and you read earlier in Deuteronomy, God had promised, "I will give you deliverance. I will give you victory." And here there's a couple setbacks. There's a defeat, and it seems like they just quit. It seems like Judah decides to fight where it's easy and leave off the places where it's hard. And there's times and places in my life where, in a sense, there's easy battles to progress in my relationship with God. There's some things that aren't hard to do as a Christian, and it's pretty easy. I can take that ground with the Lord, for the Lord. But then there's other areas where I try to do this. I try to grow in this area, and I realize this is a lot harder. This is not as easy as this over here. You know, for some people, maybe attending church on a Sunday morning is very, very easy. It's not something challenging. For other people, maybe it's brand new to them, and to give up their Sunday morning to, you know, worship with the people of God is a challenge. Maybe there's something else in your life that can be challenging. And what I see with Judah is they just give up. So they've got chariots of iron. We can't do it. Rather than continuing to go after it. In verse 20, I see a contrast. It says, "They gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said, and he expelled from there three sons of Anak." Now, how old is Caleb at this time? He's an old man. He's probably at least 80. But who is he able to defeat? Three sons of Anak. Does anybody know who Anak was? He was a giant. And he had some giant kids. Big, impressive people. Think Goliath style. And Caleb said, "I can take these guys." He did not look at this and say, "Well, it's an iron chariot. I can't go do this." He looked at his God and saw, "The Lord has promised us this land. And so I'm going to take this land. It might be hard, but I'm going to do this because the Lord has promised victory. And the Lord said, this is possible." And so you have a contrast between Judah that says, "We can't do this because they've got iron chariots." And Caleb who says, "I did do this because I trusted in the Lord, even though there were giants." And if you look at Benjamin, they said, "We couldn't go into Jerusalem." Now, what had happened with Jerusalem? Back in verse 8, it had been attacked by Judah. It had been burned down and defeated, but it looks like they didn't occupy it. And so the Jebusites moved in And then Benjamites are looking and they're like, oh, they're too strong. They retook it. And then we can't take it back. And so there's this thought of we can't do it. But if you look at verse 22, it says the house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. Now think of Bethel. This is occupied by the enemy at this point. And yet back in Genesis, years and years earlier, who had named that place Bethel? Jacob. Jacob, on his way to his uncle, he had said, this is a place of the house of God. This is where God is. And in a sense, he had claimed it. He said, this is God's place. And yet now it's no longer Bethel again. It had been renamed Luz. And what is the house of Joseph doing? They're saying, we're going to retake what had been taken again by the enemy. And yet Benjamin's not doing that with Jerusalem. So I see here just some of these tribes stopping short. They're not continuing in what they should. There's not a persistence. There's a tolerance. There's a corrosive contentment. There's a risky complacency. And I think an application for me, and maybe for you, is that the wars that are won will have battles in them that are lost. But the wars that are won are the wars where you get up again and you have a comeback after a setback. And that's where I think Judah and Benjamin, after they had a setback, they didn't come back. They didn't keep fighting. And, you know, I don't know what this might relate to in a person's life today, but maybe it could relate to addictions. Maybe it could relate to just some other struggle or wrestling in your life. And there might be things in your life that you fight against for 20 years or 30 years or longer. But to be like Judah or Benjamin is to give up and say, this is just who I am, and accept the fact rather than continue to fight against the flesh. And so here we see this stopping. And it's the beginning of the end for Israel, the beginning of the rest of this book. Verses 23 through 26, we see not only this stopping, but you see this sparing. So when Joseph, the house of Joseph, went up to Bethel, the name of the city was formerly Luz. Verse 24, when the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, please show us the entrance to the city, and we will show you mercy. So he showed them the entrance to the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword, but they let the man and all his family go. And what does the man do? The man went to the land of the Hittites, built a city, and called its name Luz, which is its name to this day. So what do? They spare someone. They go to take this city, and what were they supposed to do? Wipe everybody out. And yet they see, here's an easier way to get the city. Here's a guy who knows the inroad. We'll spare his life and not have to work so hard to take the city. And so they arrange this deal. We'll let you go free. The guy says, I don't want to die. And so he turns in his own city for his own life. And then he goes elsewhere and rebuilds and names the new city the old name, Luz. And this guy, don't think of him as like Rahab, because they spared Rahab, right? But what was different about Rahab? She had come and she hid the spies and she says, I know of your God and I believe in your God. And we've heard lots of things about your God and I want to follow your God. And they said, we will spare you on this condition that you rescue us and you hang this scarlet cord, that you believe in our God, we will spare you. And yet here, we don't see any of that in this man's life. We don't see any repentance. We don't see any conversation about him talking to them about the Lord. All he does is something that's selfishly motivated. I don't want to die. And so he turns in. And then what does he do later? He goes back to the same old thing. So you see that he's not a changed man. He just builds another city and names it Luz. So you see this sparing, which again is going to be corrosive to Israel. It reminds me of Romans 13, verse 14. For us, Romans 13, verse 14, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts. We're not to spare any aspect of that old sinful nature. Third part that we see is they settle alongside, verse 27. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth-Shean and its villages and everything. End of verse 27, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. And it came to pass when Israel was strong that they put the Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer. That's quite the name for a town. So the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them, nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalol. So the Canaanites dwelt among them and were put under tribute. Nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Akko or the inhabitants of Sidon or Ahlab, Akzib, and these other towns I'm not going to pronounce. Verse 32. So the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites and the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. And so you see here now, Israel is just settling alongside these other nations when they're supposed to drive them out. And at the beginning, you see them, in a sense, the majority, and the Canaanites, the minority. If you look at verse 29, at the end it says, the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. So in a sense, Israelites there, and you've got pockets of Canaanites around. But then if you jump down to verse 32, now Israel is willing to be the minority of the influence. So the Asherites dwelt among the Canaanites. The tribe of Asher is now the pockets within the Canaanites, and they inhabited the land, for they did not drive them out. So you see, rather than driving them out, there's an aggression and a reversion back of the Canaanites regaining ground. The Lord had told them, if you don't drive them out, they will be thorns in your side. It's a reminder of the flesh. If we don't drive out the flesh, what we don't drive out, it will drive in. It will continue to work its way even deeper and more into our life. And the last thing that we see is subjecting, verse 33 through 36. Nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Beth-Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beth-Anath, but they dwelt among the Canaanites and the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, inhabitants of Beth-Shemesh and Beth-Anath were put under tribute to them. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down to the valley. And the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Horez, in Ajalon, in Shalbim. Yet when the hand of the house of Joseph became stronger, they were put under tribute. Now the boundary of the Amorites was from the ascent of the Akrabim, from Selah and upward. And so here you have, again, two things where at the beginning, they're weak. God had said, I'll drive them out little by little. They became strong. When they're able to drive them out, they choose not to. They kind of probably decide, you know what? We can have some financial gain here. Got a lot of people to do the menial tasks that we don't want to do. And so rather than driving them out, let's just give them all our chores that we don't want. And so they do that and put them under subjection. Four different times it says that in verse 28, verse 30, verse 33, and verse 35. They're unwilling when they're able. But then in verse 34, you see they become subject to the Canaanites, that Dan is cornered by them. The Amorites force the children of Dan into the mountains, for they would not allow them to come down to the valley. And towards the end of the book, Dan's looking for a homeland. They don't have any place because they've been driven out of their allotted territory because of what's taking place here. And so they're looking for another home. And so you see in these last verses, Israel stopping, Israel sparing, Israel settling, and Israel becoming subject to and sometimes subjecting, but just living alongside rather than realizing this is something that needs to be driven out. Now, the application again for us is not with our culture. In our culture, we live alongside non-believers, and it's not our responsibility to try to, you know, make our block a holy block and just get rid of all the sinners. Our context today would be like Jeremiah 29, where God tells his people, dwell among them, build houses, plant, seek the well-being of the city. And so you may work alongside coworkers, you might live alongside neighbors that are sinners. And yes, you're a sinner too. Our responsibility isn't to drive them out, it's to win them to Christ. And so the application is internal. It relates to the sin in our own lives, the sin in our hearts. It's a heart matter for us. And the conclusion to this chapter is there's no sin yet. They haven't done anything wrong in the sense of sins of commission. It's just sins of omission at this point. They're not stepping over the boundaries of transgression, but they're setting the stage for chapter 2. It's not a crisis yet, but they're opening up that road and they're on that path. And if you think of any moral crises in this world, individuals who are in a moral crisis, it always begins in chapter 1. It always begins where they took a place where they said, you know what, I can step back. I can relax in the saddle a little bit. I don't have to be as on guard against this sin or against this temptation. And nothing may happen for a while. You may think, well, this is fine. But then chapter 2 eventually will come if there isn't this vigilance. In Philippians 3, Paul said, I press toward the prize of the goal of the upward call in Christ Jesus, forgetting the things that are behind me and reaching forward to the things that are ahead. And I think of Jesus, how in John 17, verse 4, he said, I have finished the work that you've given me to do. He didn't just run 3/4 of the way around the track and thought, that's good enough. He finished to the point where on the cross he said, it is finished. Our hope is in Jesus, who's finished the course, and he's the one who's able to give us a strength, like in Hebrews chapter 12, where it says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. He's the finisher of our faith if we look to him, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word tonight. We thank you for this new book that we're about to launch into and look at in more detail in the coming weeks and couple months ahead. And I thank you that you've laid the groundwork for where Israel started that caused them to end up where they resulted, where they ended up. That we would be able to see that the tragedies later on, it started with just a small step of compromise. It started with complacency. Lord, I pray that you would alert us to the areas of our life, that you would alert me to the areas of my life where there's that danger of complacency, of slowing down, of just easing up to the point where we no longer are progressing, where we're not growing in our walk with you. And I pray that you would protect us from that, that we would run with endurance the race that is set before us. We thank you that you are the author, the one who enables us to start out, and you're the finisher. You're the one who enables us to finish and complete well. And so we just want to look to you. We want to start our race in prayer like the children of Israel did. We want to continue to pray to you. We want to be people that realize that there's a teamwork in the Christian life, and that the Christian life it's a life of progress, and it's a life of adventure, that we would have our minds set on those things, God. In Jesus' name, amen.